You're listening to The Manic Gardener, where we dig into all things about organic and sustainable gardening, especially vegetable gardening, but not exclusively. I'm Kate Gardner, the Manic Gardener herself, so if I get ahead of myself, I'm just living up to my name. If you stick around, you'll meet Tyson.
A million times.
And more briefly, Jessica.
I need to finish building my closet first, actually.
With whom I'm going to talk about building a garden, not a closet, from the ground up. Don't forget to check out the blog, themanicgardener.com, an organic garden with twisted roots, though I admit it's been somewhat neglected recently as I learn about tracks and sync lock tracks, overdubbing, and everything else about podcasting here. But you can poke around in the archives for information about using wood ashes in your garden or the pine beetle infestation across the West or my latest kale harvest. It's autumn, and to kick off this podcast series, I thought we'd talk about starting a garden. This is a bit counterintuitive, I realize. We tend to think of gardening in conjunction with spring, you know, beginning of the year, beginning of the garden. Makes sense, but as you'll hear, while there are some disadvantages to starting a garden in the autumn, there are also some significant advantages beyond the obvious one, which is time. Garden that's ready in the spring is ready to go, and that's good. Also, spring could be an awfully busy time in the garden, what with weeding and planting and tending your starts for a new vegetable garden. It's hard sometimes to find time for a major project like digging out a garden. But as Tyson explains later, starting in the fall actually helps your soil and therefore whatever you grow in it. And so there's some real advantages to starting your garden bed months before you plant it. So if you are looking at a bed of weeds or even just sod, and I shouldn't even say just because sod can be one of the absolute worst things to dig through. If you've ever tried it, you know this. And you'd like to be looking at a garden, what do you do? To answer this, I want to introduce two young neighbors of mine, new neighbors, Jessica and Tyson, who are, as you guessed it, putting in a garden. And they appear to know what they are doing. Now, Tyson's approach to this question of starting a garden is to till and till.
A million times.
At the end of the show, I will suggest a less back-breaking approach, as easy as laying a new winter blanket over the bed as the colder weather comes on. As you heard, Jessica was otherwise engaged, building a closet to be precise. She was an English major, like me, and appears to be confirming Garrison Keillor's claim that English majors can do anything. At any rate, we'll be talking primarily with Tyson. Before starting the interview, I knew that Tyson was an undergraduate at Montana State University here in Bozeman, Montana, and that he was majoring in something to do with agriculture. When I asked him for the details, he said that although he was
technically
a senior, he'd recently declared a double major, which meant
I'm going to be in school for at least another 2 or 3 years.
To which I could only say, wow. The first of these majors,
crop science,
was not a perfect fit because
they had far too much of a focus on monocropping, large scale.
It's hard to hear him over the faucet, but he's talking about conventional agriculture that uses Roundup Ready, genetically modified seeds, lots of herbicides, and other practices that
I don't really agree with.
You might say that Tyson was too green for agriculture. It was only when I listened to the recorded interview afterwards that I realized that there was something like a theme running throughout it. I don't want to give away what it is, or hope it is. After all, it might just be my English major's mind, mining for meaning and alliterating everywhere. But assuming it is there, I want to find out whether you two can hear it. so I don't want to give it away. Yet. I will at the end. But I will say that, again in retrospect, even the seemingly random conversation at the beginning about Tyson and Jessica's house relates to that theme, which is why I decided to leave it in the final recording. When I walked into Tyson's house, the first thing I saw was a record player.
Right. State the obvious.
Oh, I forgot to mention, I'm using this bell-like sound to let you know when I'm including an aside, a definition, or something else that I've added after the initial interview. So, one more time.
State the obvious.
Maybe obvious to him, but not to an awful lot of kids his age. As I told him, I used to teach at MSU, and when I had my students over to my house once, and one of them walked in and said, "Are those records?"
Sure. Vinyl is actually one of the most printed things in Jamaica because it's easy.
This was not just a couple of records. This was boxes of vinyl LPs with stacks of old 45s in their paper slip covers on top of them. None of your clean, perfect, pure digital recordings here. Just the old scratchy stuff.
About that.
But as Tyson said,
something about a record.
Is that the only staircase up?
It's the only one.
Interesting. Interesting placement.
Right?
I mean, it looks like the upstairs must have been added on then.
We were in his kitchen, and the wooden stairs, which had no outside rail, were more or less tacked against the wall.
They made the space for it? Here, I have a whole bunch of peppers for you.
You're kidding. You grow peppers.
That note of awe in my voice? Remember, we're in Montana, so we don't have a very long growing season. I don't expect a lot of sympathy from folks north of us in Alberta and Saskatchewan, but at least they've got the advantage of longer days. And here in Bozeman, we're almost a mile high in the Rocky Mountains, which does not make it any easier. These weren't big bell peppers. They were smaller, long, and a little pointed, sort of like jalapenos, but sweet. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised, since when he and Jessica had come over to breakfast the previous weekend, he'd brought me a watermelon, and not one he'd bought in the store. He hadn't grown either the watermelon or the peppers here in Bozeman, but at his parents' place in Livingston, up and over a range of mountains and maybe 20 miles east of us. To set up that garden,
what I did is I set up, just tilled, really thoroughly tilled area that was just a grassland, essentially. I had a whole bunch of quack grass and orchard grass and stuff, and we tilled it up, pulled the sod out, banged it all off.
Yep.
So it's just the roots. I threw the roots in the compost.
Wait a minute, what order did you do this in?
Tilling first.
Before you pulled the sod up?
Yes, I just tilled the sod essentially up until it broke it apart, and then we grabbed it and busted it up.
What'd you use for the tilling?
Big old tiller.
Rototiller?
Yeah, it's out in the garage. I can show you, or our shed. It's like a big, bigger than a rototiller, big push. Like,
okay.
You know, the blades are this big spinning.
Like a foot deep it goes, or more?
Half a foot, easy.
Okay.
And that we rototilled that up first, banged off all the sod, threw the roots in a compost pile, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took some really sandy soil from the lower area of the floodplain where the cows always are. It had a whole bunch of manure in it. We scooped it, mixed it in with the soil again, tilled it, like just really tilled it really, really well.
Uh-huh.
Get all the rhizomes of the grass out. Then I tried to do the Three Sisters method where you had corn, beans around the corn, which climbed the corn, and then usually put squash at the base of the mounds.
Right.
And I tried watermelon instead. My watermelon did okay. They kind of out-competed everything else.
Huh. So how'd the corn do?
Corn did great.
Really?
My corn did very well. I tried to make a cross between the sweet corn and the purple corn, and I just let it, like, naturally blow around, and I have a couple of successful crosses.
And it tasted good?
Yeah, and it actually was sweet. Purple corn, which is apparently pretty hard to do, but I think it could have been of the direction of the cross, like the The purple corn wasn't pollen. I didn't pollinate sweet corn with purple pollen. I pollinated the purple corn with sweet corn pollen.
So usually, all the seed packets say only plant one kind of corn in, you know, a 36-mile radius,
yeah,
because they'll cross-pollinate and then you don't know what you'll get. But you wanted them to cross-pollinate.
Yes, I wanted to try and get across. I don't have any here to show you.
But how did you control which one pollinated
I
which?
Didn't. I just let it happen.
But you said you didn't do this.
Well, it was a timing. Nature did that.
Okay.
Because the pollen shed of the purple corn, it's a much earlier season corn, so it sheds its pollen way sooner. Mm-hmm. Then the tassels are out on the sweet corn, so it couldn't cross to the sweet corn.
It couldn't pollinate the sweet corn.
Exactly. And the tassels were still, like, kind of coming out when the tassels for the sweet corn came out. The purple corn, when the pollen came out for the sweet corn.
Mm-hmm.
And so the purple corn could be pollinated by the sweet corn, but it could not go the other way because its pollen had already dried out and desiccated.
But if it had already pollinated, wouldn't all of the purple corn already be pollinated by the purple corn?
That's what you'd
pollen
think, but it actually wasn't, because I had variegated patterns, which are like, normally if it would have done that already, my heads would have been solid purple, but I had a lot of purple and white ones.
You said you had a variegated pattern, meaning the kernels
were white and purple. Yeah. Mixed
color.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's where I could tell. And you could also tell because the hairs coming off the head of the ear of the corn, they'd start to pop out much later than the top of the pollen on the purple corn.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even though there's probably a very residual, there's a massive dose coming out from the
sweet corn.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And that was probably blowing onto there. Because I had it kind of set up in two squares. Like, I had a square of purple corn, I had a square of sweet corn. And the sweet corn was generally lower down on the hillside, so I think it got more water as well as being just more vigorous. And it was much taller, produced pollen for a lot longer time than
uh-huh.
the sweet corn,
uh-huh.
or the purple corn did.
Right.
And so I think that definitely had something to do with it. Like, that definitely made the purple corn keeps sending out its heads and tassels. Like, they're still sending out tiny, barely ones. Like,
they're still trying to make new
ones. A week or so ago. Like, it was trying to make another small head. So it's
the heads being
kind of,
ears
yeah,
of
yeah,
corn,
heads,
right?
Sorry,
yeah.
Ears, yeah. I've been working with wheat. And it's definitely, I mean, you could tell that, I'll pack some of these up for it. You could tell when you ate it, too. It was super sweet. Like,
uh-huh.
the corn was sweet.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it definitely was a pretty exciting thing. So I'm going to save those crosses, too. I have a couple that I'm going to dry out the ears and then save that for next year.
Uh-huh.
As well as I'm going to try and duplicate it. I'm going to try and get the same purple corn I got and the same sweet corn. I'm going to try and do that cross again and see if it works.
Interesting. I wonder, once you have picked out some of the best-looking peppers there that you're going to send home with me. I don't know why I deserve this, but
well,
I'm not going to ask.
And you fed us breakfast.
Oh, yes, but I'm also taking up your time when you're just moving into your house.
Well, and these will go bad if I don't eat them.
Oh,
and
well,
I won't be able to eat all
let
these.
Me help
exactly.
You.
So you're helping.
Okay, right. I know that kind of help. I can do that. First of all, let me get just a bit of background here. You're a senior?
This was where I learned that
I just declared a double major, though, so I'm going to be in school for at least another 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
It's also where I learned more about the first major in
crop science.
But we've been there, done that, don't need to go back. Onwards, then, to where we started to get a bit technical about what you do and don't want to do in a garden. And it all came out of the fact that Tyson had used the word monocropping when he was talking about things that he didn't really like about the crop science department.
Well, let's not call it traditional.
Yeah, conventional.
And monocropping, of course, is planting all of one particular crop. Now, why is that a problem?
Unfortunately, I did a lousy job defining monocropping. It's not planting all of one crop, it's planting only one crop, and it usually means planting that same crop over and over, year after year, on the same plot of ground. When you drive down a highway and you pass mile after mile after mile of just corn or soybeans or wheat, you're looking at a monocrop. But that still begs the question.
Now, why is that a problem?
Well, it tends to promote disease outbreaks, because if you just keep growing wheat year after year after year, not only are you mining the soil of the nutrients that wheat likes, because it's only wheat and continually being grown on there, you're also providing a really good environment for, let's say, rusts or smuts or bunts, things that are really damaging to wheat, because that's the environment it's being grown in year after year. So you're putting a lot of pressure on the plants to keep producing under worse and worse conditions.
I see. Okay.
And so you're making, what you could essentially do is make a vacuum for really nasty diseases to come in and kind of take over. And, you know, that's just basics of crop rotation. I mean, the way to break green bridges, as they're called, which is where, you know, a disease can overwinter on something, then come back the next year and get your crop, you need to just rotate out of that type of crop. So wheat, you could alternate to, let's say, peas, which is something they commonly do, and even monocropping in large-scale production is they'll go wheat 1 year, peas the next year, wheat 1 year, peas the next year. And that does a decent job of breaking it up. Like, they're different enough crops. Wheat's a monocot, and peas are a dicot. So, you know, the fungal diseases and bacterial diseases especially, which are very specific to what they attack, can generally be deterred by alternating crops. But if you, let's say, get into a 10-year rotation, so wheat is only grown on this specific field of your land once every 10 years, and it just simply keeps moving around your land, you have a lot more biological diversity in your soil, especially if you do cover crop, and you have a lot more resources in your soil for the plants to use. Because constantly monocropping also decays the soil's structure, the aggregate soil structure, and mines it of, like, organic matter, and just generally depletes
how
the soil integrity.
How does monocropping injure soil structure? So because you're sending down the same type of roots year after year?
Year after year. Okay. And generally, too, I mean, a lot of it, if you spray things, that was my phone, if you spray herbicides and, you know, pesticides or use fungicides, you really start to change the soil biology. And part of the thing that allows soil to say is be a very robust buffer is it's live. It's a live thing. And once you continually do it year after year, you really change it to a very specific set of things. And those microbes, the fungus, whatever's in the ground, can't adapt to change as well as a really widely varying set of, you know, soil biology. And if you, let's say you have 3 years in your 10-year rotation that are a cover crop where you just grow, let's say, lentils and then till them over into the soil, or sweet clover or something, you really add a lot more stuff back in the soil. You're adding all the products that the photosynthesis create, all those starches, and you're feeding that organic material back into the ground. That organic material can in turn promote soil biological diversity. And so when you, yeah, by putting organic matter in, you're really bolstering the ability soil to have more things in it. Let's say
diverse variety of microbes.
Yeah. Okay. And that allows your crops to generally be much more productive. You are also, in that aspect there, it's a double-edged sword. You can't open up for new other things like funguses or things that maybe not would have, might not have existed. But generally, if you have a really diverse soil biology, it'll be so competitive that a disease you'll have won't be a big problem, because something will tend to compete with it.
And if you keep growing one crop consistently, then you're making a niche for that.
Exactly, for that one
diseases.
Fungus. Or,
right.
And then you become dependent upon a fungicide. When funguses or bacterial diseases hit, in a system like that, they tend to explode. Whereas if you have a diverse system, it can't really explode as well. And if it does explode in, let's say, your wheat section, you at least have peas to fall back on,
right.
Carrots, whatever else you're growing.
Right. Okay.
And that's where the SFBS became a very big part of.
What's SFBS?
The Sustainable Food and Bioenergy System at MSU. It's
that
a new major.
And is that your second major?
Yes, it has a couple, I guess, subsections of it. It has a culinary production aspect. It has a crop production aspect. That's what I'm in. That's my option, I suppose you would call it. And then there's
I think a bioenergy and engineering systems, like engineering greenhouses that are more sufficient and sustainable, cold frames, stuff like that. And so there's three different aspects. So, I mean, you don't have to be a farmer to get into the SFBS. You can be into cooking, you can be into engineering, whatever.
Sustainable food.
And bioenergy systems.
And bioenergy systems.
I think so. I think that's what it is.
You think that's what you mean? Okay.
I'm going to give you a couple more actions.
No, by all means. We better step outside and do that bit before we forget to. First, though, I want to remind you about a couple of features at the end of the show. I'll give you your gardening tip for the week. And then I'll reveal what I see as the theme running through this week's interview before saying a couple of words about next week's show. Now, when I first saw this, it was a pile of dirt and boards, and now I am looking at a large L-shaped garden bed, clearly a garden bed, with the boards being held together by braces.
Yep, metal braces.
Yeah, metal braces. And it's filled with a soil that does not look local.
It's a mix. Half of the soil that I had in here was just the soil that was under the weed mat that was in our backyard before I ripped it up and I tilled it up. And Bozeman has a very clay soil.
It does.
And so it's really dense. And what I did is I took some of that sandy soil from my parents' house in Livingston, I brought it over and I dumped it in here and mixed it in to kind of push the soil structure away from being so clay.
Now, how did you mix it?
I just simply used a tiller and shoveled a whole lot and had a couple people come help me. And I'm probably going to add some more because it's still very clayey.
How do you protect against a soil horizon? I've heard that it's a problem if you dump one kind of soil on top of another kind of soil. The happy little roots go down through the first kind, they hit the second kind, they freak out, and they stop growing.
Yeah.
Could you have that problem?
I've only been able to till probably a foot down from the original soil level, and there is a very gnarly clay soil pan, like much lower, and so I mean that's gonna be part of it, but the best tool I've had for mixing soil, really getting down and breaking up a layer below, is a pickaxe. That's backbreaking.
Yep.
And so you need a couple strong young people to come bust it up, and that's been by far one of the biggest tools that I've used.
So in an ideal world, before you tilled up these two kinds of soil together, what would you have done to make sure you didn't have a flat soil horizon that would stop roots? Would breaking through that other layer below here and there be
it'd be pretty good
in the right direction?
Yeah, it would definitely be a step in the right direction. You're promoting soil drainage, and you're also, you know, promoting a vacuum for the roots to grow into.
Do you mean promoting a vacuum?
Well, you're promoting by breaking up that soil pan, you're promoting you're making the soil looser, and that, you know, roots go the path of least resistance. So if you have a kind of broken up section, they're going to try and push down into that. So if you just go through and systematically kind of checkerboard the area before you pile up
with a pickaxe,
or
something,
or a spud bar, the big metal bars for pounding post holes or digging those work really well too. If you go through and just kind of systematically do that and kind of push on it and get it as loose and crumbled as you can, and then till that if you can, and then dump more on, and just keep mixing your soil really thoroughly the whole time you're doing this process, that's probably one of the best ways to just kind of make sure you have an even soil distribution. That's what I did in my garden, was we just tilled it a million times.
Right.
In the one in Livingston.
Right. Okay. Did you have serious roots to worry about here? You said there was weed cloth down, but grass growing on top of that, right?
Yeah, they'd actually, I don't know how the grass had done it, but it had actually managed to punch up a lot of it through the weed mat.
Whoa.
But, yeah, and so the weed mat was kind of acting like a substrate that the roots attached themselves to. And so when we ripped up the weed mat, a lot of the roots were just simply attached to the bottom of it, and so
it
pulled it back. And so this, I had a really, really clean area to till and just use. I didn't really have to compete with the sod that I did in Livingston.
So the grass,
Wait a minute. You said the grass had come up through the weed mat, which it ain't supposed to do because that's what weed mat is for, I thought.
It was probably a 30-year-old weed mat.
True. But on the other hand, it didn't grow down into the soil beneath the weed mat.
I think part of that was probably because it was a really heavily clay soil, and grass tends to be a very fibrous root system. It stays in the top soil horizon, and it doesn't really punch down deep. It's not like corn or sunflowers. Uh-huh. So it can send it 20 feet, you know, 10 to 20 feet down. And so it definitely had something to do with the whole horizon, soil horizon, but I also think it's because the weed mat probably held a lot of moisture right at the top, and held enough that it made a good area for the grass to hang on to. If you can't see it on the podcast, but this is the weed.
So we're looking at a mat of grassy weeds that is close to an inch thick.
And that was,
so it created a layer of thatch on top of the weed mat, and that supported it.
Yeah, and these all were just rhizomes that, I mean, at some point one of these had punched through to the top
and then spread out.
Because I think they also had this, which is wood chips. I think they had a wood chips to over the top of the weed mat to kind of try and hold stuff down, but it in turn ended up acting
soil. In the end an organic matter, right?
And you can see there's horiolissum, which is a invasive weed, not that bad a one, but
no, your dog is eating an apple.
Good.
All right,
get a good mix of stuff.
So explain what's wrong with clay soil.
There's a lot of things right with clay soil, but it's wrong because it tends to be very hard because it's the smallest of the soil particles. There's silt, sand, and clay.
And which is the largest?
Sand is the largest soil particles, and clay is the smallest. Silt is in between.
Okay.
And Bozeman's clay soil is, I think it's a Blackmore soil series, which is named for the Blackmore, you know, Blackmore Mountain, all that.
Yeah, there's a Blackmore Mountain south of here.
Yeah.
I've climbed it.
They were a big family back in the day, but I digress. And the soil horizon, it's largely clay. It was a lus. And what it was, lus is really, really fine, tiny particles, usually clay, and they're blown from massive distances. And so they tend to pick up nutrients in the air and stuff. And then they blew up against the bridges and kind of settled down here, kind of a big vortex built, and just kind of eventually dumped a lot of really fine soils in this area of the Gallatin Valley over couple thousand years, probably more than that, probably 50,000 years. A long, you know, geologic process of dumping the soil here. And if you go to Belgrade,
which is 15 miles away or something,
it's completely different. It's a very riverbed like very big rocks, and it's because it was literally the mountains just stopped the sediment here over in Bozeman and just dumped it here.
We're right against the mountains. Belgrade's not. And that's why they can mine gravel over there. We can't.
Well, and it's kind of kind of depressing at times because all the agriculture, a majority of the agriculture in the Gallatin Valley is out that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And the soil that is probably would be much more productive for it is over in Bozeman, and we're building on it. But so I'm trying to undo it with my garden.
Right. It's a step. So what is so great about clay soil?
Well,
there's a lot of things right about it.
Well, the small soil particles, they have a larger surface area in terms. It's kind of counterintuitive. Yeah. It has more surface, like 1 gram of clay soil has more surface area than a gram of sandy soil because the particles are smaller, so therefore there's more of them together, and therefore they have more surface area.
Each part, compared to its mass, each particle has more surface area.
Yeah, compared to a sandy one. And so therefore they can hold a lot more nutrients, like phosphorus, potassium, a lot of things like that. Like Montana is actually one of the few heavily agricultural states that doesn't have a really depleted soil level of phosphorus. And that's because we have a lot of calcic, I want to say, that's not the right word, but we have a lot of soils that have come from parent materials that either had clay in them or, you know, at some point along the line, and so they're able to really cling really tightly to this phosphorus. So tightly, in fact, a lot of the time, that plants can't get the phosphorus off of there. A lot of the nutrients in clay soil, there might be a ton of nutrients in there, but plants can't peel those particles off there because they're so tightly held by the clay. And so there's...
It sounds like a problem.
A soil structure triangle, and there's clay in one corner, sand in the other, and silt in the other. And right in the middle is the combination of all of those three. And that's where a ton of plants tend to do very well.
Your sandy loams and silty loams.
Exactly, where the loams, right? Where there's definitely some clay particles in there to hold a lot of the nutrients, but there's sandy soils to promote drainage. And, you know, the silt is the nice in-between. And so clay soils tend to have a lot of problem with proper drainage. Like, they'll get waterlogged very easily. Mm-hmm. And they can, you know, get very compacted.
Again, because the particles are so small, they just pack up against each other?
Yeah, and I mean, that's why people have used it for pottery for thousands of years. Because of the soil, the clay structure, it's just really amazing. Like, it just can pack into sheets, almost. It's very... You know, the structure is very small and dense and can get almost crystalline in certain aspects.
Uh-huh.
And whereas sand, you know, big and disorganized and jumbled. And so there's, you know, it can leach. You can leach your nutrients really fast in a sandy soil and you can lose a lot.
They can leach right out of the soil when it rains. They can just peel off all the granules and gone.
Or, well, let's say you add, you know, bone meal or...
Vermicompost being that champagne of composts, worm droppings.
Vermicompost. You add something like that in a sandy soil, you water it, I'd say about 50%, if not more, is probably just going to go straight through the profile, straight down into your water table.
Wow.
Whereas in a clay soil, a lot of it will get caught. But sometimes in this clay soil, let's say in my garden, it might just stick to the soil, and your plants can't get to it.
How do you loosen it? How do you make those nutrients? So you're saying basically that your clay soil is maybe more nutrient-rich, but it also hangs on to the nutrients so tightly that they're not available to your plants.
Exactly.
What do you do?
You try to make that nice mix in the middle of those three soil types. So if you have a really clay soil, add some sand. If you have a really sandy soil, add some clay.
Now, hang on. I've read many, many times, I don't believe it, but I've read it, that if you add sand to clay soil, you're going to end up with cement. It's all over the advice not to do this.
I've heard that, and I think it's just I need to add it in proper percentages. I added a very, very small amount of sand to my garden. I might add more eventually, but...
Well, were you adding pure sand?
It wasn't pure sand. It's a sandy silt soil. And
okay.
So you want to use natural living soil from somewhere else. Don't just grab sand and start pouring it on there.
Uh-huh.
But because that, I mean, you're adding soil diversity, biological diversity, but you're also adding a mix of not just sand, but you're adding some silt too. So there's a transition between your really big sand particles and your really small clay particles. You have a lot to work with.
So you lived in a place that had very sandy soil. What would you add? Where would you get it?
One thing that's actually one of the best things for promoting a healthy structure, maybe not adding nutrients, but structure, is compost. Compost does amazing things. Let's say my garden does turn into cement because I added a sandy soil to it.
Yeah.
All I have to do is, you know, maybe a year or two of adding some really good compost. It'll change the granular and aggregate structure of my soil completely different from the soil that's 5 feet away that's just really heavy clay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, it's a kind of a process. If it doesn't work 1 year, just kind of keep at it. And like I said, what you're shooting for is that nice in-between area where, you know, it's got the clay, it's got sand, and it's got silt. And it's tough to do, and you kind of have to work with what your environment gives you. So over in Bozeman, I'm obviously going to have to work with a much clayier soil than I am in Livingston.
Uh-huh.
And you plant crops that can tolerate that, like garlic and, you know, things like that tend to do pretty well in clay soils. And, you know, potatoes do pretty well in some sandy soils, but they both can grow in each, but they might not do as well as they had in, let's say, the different soil type.
Okay. So what is your plan here once you get this? Okay, you've got your structure in, you've got your soil mix. What's next?
I have to, the soil is kind of just piled high right now. I have to go back through it. I'm probably going to hit it again with the tiller once more. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try and add some compost to it to kind of kickstart the biological activity before winter sets in and all the biological activity pretty much grinds to a halt. I'm going to mix it up real well, and I'm actually going to plant a couple things that need to overwinter. I'm going to plant winter wheat around the edges just to kind of... I had a whole bunch and I need to use it. And I don't think I'll make bread or anything. But and then I'm going to plant garlic in one of the probably the sunnier section just to have something that I can have going next year. But I'm also going to cover it for the winter with, let's say, an old rug or a tarp or something.
Now, you're not going to try to plant a cover crop?
The winter wheat might act as it. That's what I'm considering throwing that in there right now just to have something for next year. But it also can be very competitive. If I do want to start something next year, I'd have to go through and pull out all that sod that grew
right
before winter.
Right. And what about planting a legume that you could
plant under? That's true. A legume, a sweet clover, yellow sweet clover is really well adapted for the Montana area, southwest Montana, like Livingston, Bozeman area. That could work really well. You can't really do much with it. If you have goats or cows, though, they'd love to eat that. And that's a legume. I think all clovers. And
what's so great about planting legumes?
They not only can they fix nitrogen.
What does that mean?
They have a soil symbiosis with a bacteria. I can't remember the name
Doesn't
of it.
Doesn't matter. We'll let that one go.
I should know it, though.
So they've got a close relationship with some soil bacteria?
Yes, and it allows them to fixate atmospheric forms of nitrogen. So it allows the N2, which is the most, by far the most prevalent gas in our atmosphere,
right.
It sucks it out and literally puts it into the soil.
And most plants can't do this?
Most plants can't do it. Legumes can, but it requires proper inoculation. You need to plant the plants into an area that either already has that soil bacteria, or you can get just from most garden stores, Planet Natural, I guarantee you, has that. You can just go and you can get a little powder and you just dust your seeds in it before you plant them. And that really over doubles your chances of having a proper inoculation and proper soil.
And at that point, the legumes, which are all your peas, all your beans, lots of garden crops, will then be able to get the nitrogen they need from the atmosphere instead of from the soil, right?
Yes. And you have to be pretty... There's sometimes, I think, peas and beans, they require a different bacterial inoculation. So do your research first and find that you're getting the right inoculation for the right plant. And make sure inoculants can go bad. Make sure, you know, the guy that's selling to you doesn't pull it off the shelf and, you know, wipe off a whole bunch of dust and say, oh, here you go, because it might be bad.
Oh, if it's very old.
Yeah, and some of them need to be refrigerated. It's all very dependent. So make sure whatever you're planting, if it's a legume, you're getting the proper inoculant.
Okay.
Because just, you know, throwing powder on your seed and planting it doesn't mean you're going to get proper symbiosis.
Okay, it's got to be the right one, and it's got to be young.
Yeah, it's got to be... It's
young
be
and active.
Exactly. It's got to be alive, and you can't...
Right, because it's a bacterium.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that helps a lot. That's probably a pretty good idea, because sweet clover is a biennial, so it's probably better to do that if you're going to... do that. You'd want to leave that plot alone for a year or two so it could really grow, and then it'd just die off and you could mix it right into your soil and it'd help boost your organic matter.
So that you use on a plot that you intended to leave fallow for a whole year.
Yes. And that fallow, leaving something truly dirt fallow like they do in, let's say, the Golden Triangle, where they'll till and then leave it fallow the next year, which is a pretty old practice for in dry land farming, especially, to help the soil boost its moisture content for the next year.
Okay, slow down. Where's the Golden Triangle?
Golden Triangle's up by Haver.
Okay, so it's Haver, an area here in Montana.
Yeah, it's where we do a lot of our wheat farming.
Okay, and now why would you leave till and then leave land completely bare? I thought that was an invitation to the weeds.
And it's an invitation to erosion and a whole bunch of other problems. But it has been shown to, especially in much drier areas of the state, it helps promote soil moisture intake. So let's say this year, which was really rainy off the bat, that someone had tilled up their fields and just left it bare, that soil, it's not making anything. There's no plants coming up, especially in these large-scale production. They're just spraying their field, and so nothing comes up. So nothing uses that water. It just slowly seeps into the soil profile, and the soil particles kind of hold on to it for the year. And it's not the most effective way because...
So they're also, you say they're going to spray a broad spectrum herbicide to keep the weeds back.
Yeah, to keep or volunteer crops from the year before. They don't want anything growing on that soil because anything growing on there uses moisture. They don't want moisture use. It's a pretty old and outdated thing, and Montana's one of the last states really holding on tightly to our wheat fallow system, and it has its advantages, but I think that time for that kind of advantage and mentality and technique is long since passed. We need to start using a little more cover crops and stuff like that to kind of promote our structure. Because if you promote a good, healthy soil structure, it's going to hold on to water anyway.
Okay. And now you're clearly doing a sustainable garden project here. Is it strictly organic or not?
I haven't added a single herbicide to anything I've ever grown, so I don't
or
plan
pesticide?
On it. No, not I don't even really like BT that much. Organic pesticides, organic herbicides,
and
pyrethrum,
BT
which BT Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a bacterium which is found naturally in soils. It's a lot. Organic farmers have used it for a long time to spray on their crops. It's an insecticide. It deters insects from feeding on it, eating it.
Uh-huh.
And they'll spray it on crops, you know, to deter insects. And they've used it for a long time. It's not harmful to people. To this day, hasn't been proven to be harmful to people. I shouldn't say that. But
why don't you like it?
Anything that really is designed to kill a large scale of things, I don't really agree with, because you don't know if you're killing beneficial insects or your predatory insects. Because let's say you have flea beetle that's feeding on your kale,
right,
and it's eating it all up. You can go out and spray pyrethrum or Bacillus thuringiensis, both of these organic products, but you could be killing these, you know, your ladybugs and other things that are feeding on the insects that you're trying to kill. You could be destroying your beneficials as well as your pests.
Hey, Jessica, you need some help there?
Oh, that's fine. I've got so much to take in. No worries. I need to finish building my closet first, actually.
She's going to build a closet. Okay. Right.
Oh, I see.
This is where Tyson opened the back of the car, and I saw the piles of clothes within.
Well, do you have any other pressing questions?
Yes, I do. Why are you doing all of this in the autumn?
And it honestly probably would have helped in some ways to do it in the spring. It would be much harder, though, in the clay soil. If you till up a clay soil when it's wet, it has a tendency to stick together and turn into almost like a rock. And so by doing this in the drier parts of the year, it's, you know, I'm trying to minimize that risk, but I'm also opening myself up for all the weed seeds that are being shed right now. There's probably going to be quite a few getting into my garden, and so I'm going to have to do a lot of weeding later. But by doing it now, I'm also a lot, by, you know, leaving the soil kind of open to the air, or maybe not the air, but, you know, unused and kind of mixed up, the like particles of like phosphorus or potassium, which can tend to cling tightly to soil, will slowly peel off through the winter. Well, maybe not through the winter, but as the springtime rolls around, they can start peeling off, you know. And
does that mean they're
going to
disappear?
Mobile? No.
Or does that mean they'll be available for plants?
Some will probably disappear and leach out, yes. But it's will hopefully increase the availability for the stuff that I'm going to plant this fall. And so they'll be available right away for it. As well as
I'm planting. Because you've prepared it now.
And I'm planting fall seeded crops, which need to be seeded in the fall. So I needed to prep it now.
Well, there's what you said about clay soils in particular, but I thought wet soils in general, you weren't supposed to work them. That's you know, in capital letters. Don't dig around in your wet soils because you'll destroy the soil structure. The soil will start to just stick to itself, eliminating all of the air passageways between the soil aggregates, and you're going to have a problem.
You could, and you definitely will, especially if you're doing this on a large scale over and over. But on a garden scale, it's okay as long as you continue to amend your soil with organic matter and compost. You can really undo a lot of that damage that you've done.
So digging once, if you have a really wet spring, the way that we did this year, for instance, it's okay to go ahead and dig. You're not going to destroy your soil structure.
You will. Just definitely keep, I mean, you have to keep an eye on it. You can't just till it and forget about it. You got to, you know, if you, let's say, till your clay soil in the, when it's wet and it turns into those big hard rocks, go back out there when it's dry and bust those up so it can kind of break it down. Maybe till it again and add some compost or bone meal or vermicompost, whatever you're going to do. Definitely add that when you're moving the soil around. You want to treat your soil pretty well. You don't want to simply just, you know, run it over with a tiller and assume it'll be okay. You definitely want to keep adding things to it. And that's where cover crops can do a lot, because they'll add that back in just naturally.
Right.
Rather than you having to go through the energy-intensive process of composting.
And these are crops that you plant after you harvest in the fall?
Yeah, you can do a lot of fall-seeded cover crops. You can do winter wheat. You can do clover, like yellow sweet clover. You can do, there's tons. Definitely recommend legumes. You can do alfalfa. But generally things that are morphologically adapted to vernalizing, which is overwintering, that's what...
Don't they just die in the winter, though?
Not all things. Winter wheat vernalizes. It actually needs that in order to send up heads the next year. Hmm. It's part of its growth cycle. It needs that. Just like garlic.
It needs the cold.
It needs it. Yeah, so it needs to grow in a warm part of the year, over winter, and then be ready to pop up the next year.
So what do you do in the spring? You have all this stuff popping up where you want to plant vegetables. Now what?
Well, that's what the winter wheat's kind of been problematic. You can have it. It's nice, but I'm not going to mill all this. And so I'll probably end up just pulling up the sod and composting the root.
Then if you just pull it up, what's the point in planting it in the first place?
It not only held things in the fall, held down your soil, and the winter, it keeps the soil from blowing away and so on and so forth. So to have something growing in your soil all the time is better than not having anything in there.
But I would have thought that it's also taking out nutrients.
It is. But that's why, especially in cover crops, if you just till them generally back in, it'll kill the crop. And those nutrients just return right back to the soil.
And that's what is done frequently with clovers, especially,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yellow sweet clover. There's Bob Quinn. He's a big organic farmer outside of Big Sandy. That's one of his key crops in his crop rotation, his cover crop, is he uses yellow sweet clover. And he crimps it, which is goes over it with a big roller to just kind of bend it down and break it in half.
In the spring?
Sometimes he can do it even in the middle of the summer, kind of, just to kind of kill it. Because it's setting a lot of growth, but he does it before it sets seed. And so the seeds won't go back in the soil, but you're getting all that the body of the plant.
The organic matter.
And you're getting it at its peak and then crimping it over, and then you're going to till that back in the soil next year.
And you also get all that nitrogen that the legumes can fix, right?
Exactly. Okay. Hopefully. That's one of the big goals. You can't always guarantee there's going to be inoculation or you're going to have
okay,
it.
Okay, right.
Yes, generally. And
I thought if they grew...
They will. It's just sometimes they don't. They're not inoculated. Like I pulled up a lot of my beans this year in my garden in Livingston, and none of them had nodules on the bottom because I didn't inoculate any of them. And so
I thought they wouldn't grow if they weren't inoculated.
No, they will grow. They will just not be as vigorous.
And they won't actually deposit nitrogen.
Yeah, they won't add any nitrogen back to the soil.
So how do you check? You pull up one of your plants and you look at the roots, and what are you looking for?
Little nodules or balls on the roots.
How big are they?
Very small, like the size of a, maybe a little bigger than a pen cap. Maybe, probably smaller than that. And what you're really looking for is you can split those nodules in half, and you're looking for red in the middle. And that is like a hemoglobin, which is, it's just part of the biology of the plant and the symbiosis with the bacteria. And it's what, essentially, that's a good confirmation that you have proper inoculation.
Okay.
Or those red nodules.
we'll flee. That's the sound of Jessica sawing just outside the kitchen door. It doesn't last too long. You've got your garden started.
Started.
You've mentioned bone meal twice. Now,
bone meal, we don't need it so much in Montana, but essentially what that is a... You could take an animal's bones, crush them up, and add them to your soil, and that adds calcium, phosphorus, potassium, lots of nutrients back in your soil. But a lot of them aren't available to plants, so let's say you mix in a whole bunch of bone meal into my garden, not all that phosphorus is going to be available. So you'd have to grow a crop that can make it available, such as buckwheat. And buckwheat, what it does is its soil, or its roots, acidify the soil. And that change in pH makes the phosphorus peel off of the soil particles. So it makes the phosphorus available to the next following crop.
Now, of course, we live in a very alkaline environment.
Yes.
Here. If someone is, say, from the Northeast, where they get lots more rain than we do,
okay,
and it's much more acidic soil, they can skip the buckwheat?
Very possibly. Yeah. Because there's a high likelihood that if you already have an acidic soil and you add in bone meal, that it's probably going to just start becoming pretty much directly available. But if you want to guarantee that you make those nutrients available, such as phosphorus or something that needs acidification or a lowering of pH, you could add sulfur. Sulfur acidifies the soil, elemental forms of it. That's organic too. You could just mix a little in with the bone meal and it'd become pretty much directly available to the plants almost. I mean, and the more time you give it in the soil, you don't want to give it too long because then you can lose nutrients, but if you give the soil a little time to work on everything that you mixed in, it definitely helps the plants grow better.
So that would be another argument for starting in the fall.
Exactly.
You said you were going to cover your garden with a rug.
Or
now, are you trying to keep it nice and cozy? You don't want it to get cold?
Partially. But
I heard of baby in your garden, but this is really extreme.
No. What I'm trying to do, too, is prevent erosion. I'm also trying to prevent a lot of the... although I'm probably going to be preventing water from getting into it from the snow, it's primarily to keep soil down, as well as I should have done it already to keep weed seeds out.
Now, wait a minute. You're talking about a garden in your backyard. It's a normal backyard. it's how big is that garden?
Oh, no,
have you measured it?
No, I should have before you came over. I'd guess no more than 100 square feet, easy.
Okay, and you're worried about soil erosion.
Every time you mix up soil, you should be worried about soil erosion, because it can always blow away, especially those clay particles, those tiny ones. Doesn't take much. And
really?
Yeah, and just generally, it also helps keep things that you don't want popping up. It helps keep them down. So when you when I peel that carpet back next year, it'll have kind of bake the soil a little, hopefully, and I won't have to weed it as vigorously as if I had just left it open all year exposed to the elements. But again, what I'm doing, I mean, it's not a guaranteed good thing that I'm doing that. It could have its negative effects, so that's why I'm probably planning on covering half and see what happens to the other half.
You'll check.
Exactly. And see which works better.
So tell me which fertilizers you're going to mix in, and
I don't know, actually, if I'm going to mix any in. I kind of want to see how it performs without it. Yeah, I didn't mix any in my Livingston garden, other than the manure-rich soil.
Okay, well, it had all that, though.
Yeah, but and this soil that I had tilled up in the first place hadn't been raised. Nothing had been raised on it other than wild grasses. And so it wasn't really heavily mined for anything else.
Right, right. It hadn't been depleted.
And the same thing happened here. All that was growing on it was a grass and a weed mat. So it didn't have a lot of things using those nutrients, and hopefully by adding the sand and some of the compost, I'm kind of mixing it up. I'm going to make a lot more of those nutrients that have kind of remained dormant. I'm going to make them available
for
garlic and the winter wheat and everything that I'm planting.
All right, well, we will be back to find out how it works out.
We'll see for sure. It's an experiment.
I think it's always an experiment. Thank you, Tyson.
Thank you, Kate.
Time for this week's garden tip. I promised an alternative way of starting a garden, something simpler or at least physically easier than Tyson's heavy-duty tilling and pickaxe-wielding and so on. And I compared it to laying a new blanket on the bed as cold weather comes on. It really is pretty close to that, because in its simplest version, it consists of taking a sheet of black plastic and laying it over the sod or weeds where you hope to have a garden next spring, tacking it down in one way or another, and then leaving it alone. It can't really get much simpler than that. This achieves two things. It deprives the weeds of light and of water, and then it also bakes them. The hot sun, or any sun, that falls on the plastic creates an extreme heat underneath, and that will help kill the plants. This is one reason why it has to be black plastic. Clear plastic simply won't work as well. It allows light through, and it does not create as much heat underneath. So go for your black plastic. Now, obviously, this won't do half of what Tyson did with all of his additions of sandier soil or compost or organic fertilizers, but it's a whole lot better than nothing. So if you don't have time for the whole large-scale garden production, try this, and then you can do more soil preparation in the spring. For a slightly fancier version, throw down a couple of inches of compost before you put down the mat. The compost gives the worms and soil microbes something to feed on, so you'll have taken a big step towards actually improving the soil as well as killing your weeds. And now for that theme, in case you missed it, here are a couple of tips. Tyson kept recommending things that would
promote soil biological diversity.
Recommending practices that would lead to
widely varying set of, you know, soil biology.
And arguing for breadth, diversity, change, and variety over and over again. This came up in terms of what you grow. A variety of crops helps protect any one of those crops from being attacked by disease or by pests. Rotating your crops, changing where they grow within your plots, also helps to protect against disease and pests. A variety of soil microbes, again, achieves many of the same purposes. Again and again, this is what came up as I was talking with Tyson. And when I looked back over the whole interview, I was startled to discover that one of the very first things we had talked about was his corn crop, where he had encouraged two different varieties to cross-pollinate so that he got a corn that had both white and purple kernels. The moral here seems to be that sometimes the impure is what is wonderful in our world. From those vinyl records, old-fashioned, imprecise, analog technology, and I'm sure much scratched up, subject to wear and tear, to the stress laid on variety in the soil itself. Today's conversation was a celebration, not of purity, but of the rich breadth, the cornucopia that we can find in life itself and in our gardens. That's it for today. Join me next week when I'll be talking with Jason and Yvonne Kim, who grow organic seed potatoes here in Montana's Gallatin Valley. Have a good week, and may your garden grow well.